Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Infectious Diseases. This podcast will discuss the current and future best practice for the management of non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis, including risk factors for acute exacerbations, the management of chronic infection, and available and emerging pharmacotherapeutic strategies. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from InSmed Incorporated. This medical education is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, my name is Charles, or Chuck Daly, and I am Chief of the Division of Mycobacterial and Respiratory Infections at National Jewish Health. I'm also Professor of Medicine at National Jewish, the University of Colorado, and Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this discussion on current and future best practice for the management of non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis. With me today is Dr. Anne O'Donnell. She is Chief of the Division of Pulmonary Medicine, Critical Care, and Sleep Medicine at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. Welcome, Dr. O'Donnell. I'm also joined by Professor Stefano Aliberti, who is Professor of Respiratory Medicine at Humanitas University and Director of the Respiratory Department also at Humanitas Research Hospital in Milan, Italy. And welcome, Professor Aliberti. In this video, we will be covering three topics. First, we'll address disease prevalence and risk factors for acute exacerbations. Then we'll move on to a discussion of management of chronic infection, and finally, available and emerging pharmacotherapeutic strategies. I'd like to begin a discussion today with our panelists, and I'll start with some background on disease prevalence and risk factors for acute exacerbations. The incidence and prevalence of non-CF bronchiectasis appears to be increasing. There are data that are available from both the US and the UK to highlight this point. In the US, the incidence was demonstrated to be 29 cases per 100,000 adults in 2013. In that same study, the prevalence was significantly higher at 139 cases per 100,000. And in another study, there was a significant increase of 8.7% per year in a U.S. Medicare outpatient claims database that looked in the interval from 2000 to 2007. In the U.K., the incidence is also increasing. Looking at 2004 to 2013, we can see significant increase, particularly in older individuals. And probably most notable in the data from the U.K. is the very high incidence in those who were older in the 60, 70, and 80 age group. Now, one of the most important things we do in the management of non-CF bronchiectasis is treat acute exacerbations and, more importantly, try to prevent them. Pulmonary exacerbations are defined as deterioration in three or more symptoms for at least 48 hours. These are some of the symptoms that we might see would worsen, like cough, sputum production with purulent sputum, increasing breathlessness, fatigue, or hemoptysis. So I'm going to bring the panel in right now. Dr. O'Donnell, Dr. Aliberti, I'd like to ask a few questions regarding non-CF bronchiectasis. And the first is, I didn't go into the etiologies, and I just wonder, Dr. Aliberti, I'll go to you first. What are some of the primary or main etiologies of non-CF bronchiectasis?
Thank you, Dr. Daly, and happy to be with you today. The etiologies of non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis in the adult population is really heterogeneous. We can recognize usually congenic diseases that can cause bronchiectasis at a pulmonary level, and we also have acquired etiologies. First of all, I would like to underline that although we are investigating etiologies, especially in the tertiary care centers with different tests and blood exams, up to 40 or even 50% of our patients have idiopathic bronchiectasis. This means we are not able to identify an etiology of that. In the remaining 60-50% of the population, we have post-infective bronchiectasis as a result of an important low respiratory tract infection. or even tuberculosis. Post-tuberculosis bronchiectasis is an etiology of this disease. Bronchiectasis can be related to genetic diseases. As I mentioned, cystic fibrosis is one of that. Primary ciliary dyskinesia is another genetic disease. And we also have a few and recent data about the possible association between bronchiectasis and AATD, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Bronchiectasis could be also associated with both primary and secondary immunodeficiencies, like a common variable immunodeficiency. And we have an association between bronchiectasis and several other systemic diseases, like connective tissue diseases, inflammatory bowel diseases, and there are some pathogens that are related to bronchiectasis as an etiology. I mean, non-tuberculous mycobacteria can cause bronchiectasis, and there is also a clear association between bronchiectasis and ABPA, allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. So an heterogeneity of possible etiologies in bronchiectasis, but what we are asked to do is to find treatable etiologies of bronchiectasis. This is suggested by the majority of the guidelines, because there are some etiologies that can be treated or even managed in a specific care, in a tertiary care centers, and this might have a big impact on patient quality of life and other clinical outcomes.
Thank you. Dr. O'Donnell, just curious, in your practice, what proportion of the patients would you say have idiopathic bronchiectasis?
Yes, Chuck, even after a fairly extensive evaluation of the patients, I would say at least 30 to 40% of patients are deemed idiopathic, and that we can't find a specific underlying etiology.
While I have you there, Anne, what are the key signs and symptoms that make you think about underlying bronchiectasis when you see a patient in clinic?
Yes, the key thing is cough, and the cough is usually productive. And often these patients have a history of multiple rounds of antibiotics being given for quote unquote bronchitis. Another important symptom is shortness of breath, occasionally chest pain. One of the big symptoms and signs that I see patients referred for is hemoptysis. Although this is relatively uncommon, it certainly does signal the possibility of having bronchiectasis. And then these patients often have systemic complaints like fatigue, occasionally low-grade fevers, and sometimes night sweats and loss of weight.
Okay. Dr. Aliberti, anything to add to that?
Well, one more thing is that, at least in my clinical practice, it's always important to investigate the etiologies and clinical signs and symptoms of our patients every time we are seeing them in the clinic, because over a year, signs and symptoms can change because the immune system is changing, more comorbidities might appear. So it's important to recheck about that and to identify those symptoms that might be due also to other etiologies, like I'm thinking about gastroesophageal reflux diseases and cough. This is a common comorbidity in our patients and might have an impact on this treatable symptom, which is cough. So this is something that we tend to do in our clinical practice.
Okay, thank you. Dr. O'Donnell, another question for you. What impact do you think acute exacerbations have on the quality of life of your patients?
Yes, Chuck, these exacerbations really are impactful for patients. Not only do they usually have to take an antibiotic for the exacerbation, sometimes that requires an intravenous antibiotic. And we also know that the symptoms of an exacerbation often last a long period of time, such that patients are potentially missing work or missing school or really just, you know, feel poorly, and the impact of the exacerbation really outlives the time that they need to be on antibiotics. The other thing I would say is that these acute exacerbations do have a impact on the prognosis of the patient, and the more frequent exacerbator has a worse, longer-term prognosis with this disease.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank both of you, Dr. Aliberti and Dr. O'Donnell, for your comments and participating in today's panel discussion. Thank you. In this section, we're going to discuss management of chronic infection. Most studies have reported that 60% or less of patients with non-CF bronchiectasis have a chronic infection. But there's no current standardized definition for chronic infection. One general definition is that the patient has two or more consecutive cultures, over 50% of cultures positive for the same pathogen within 6 or more months, and samples taken 1 or more months apart. When we think about treatment for chronic infection, we can think about this in several ways. One are those that we have evidence to support the recommendation for use, such as mechanical airway clearance, mucolytic agents such as nebulized saline, and the use of oral or IV antibiotics, such as macrolides. Then we have some treatments that we don't have good data to support, such as using long-term inhaled antibiotics such as gentamicin, tobramycin, colistin, ciprofloxacin, or some mucolytic agents. And then we have some treatments for which we have recommendations against, such as long-term bronchodilators and corticosteroids, and some mucolytic agents. I'd like to also address this idea of eradication. Now, some clinical guidelines recommend inhaled antibiotics for the treatment of early infection with Pseudomonas aeruginosa. The European Respiratory Society guidelines suggest not to use eradication protocols for other organisms. So I'd like to bring the panel in now, Dr. O'Donnell, Dr. Aliberti, and see if we can address some of these issues. Dr. O'Donnell, let me ask you first, what is the impact of these varying definitions for chronic infection on clinical practice and possibly patient outcomes?
Yes, Chuck, this does raise some points of confusion as to how to define a chronic infection or chronic colonization. But I do think the definition you cited of using two or more positive cultures is a helpful one, because we really do need to target our treatments, particularly our antibiotic treatments, at the specific pathogen that we identify. So we know that Pseudomonas-infected patients have a worse prognosis, so it's very important to find that organism. In certain parts of the world, we also need to identify if the patient has non-tuberculous mycobacterial infection, because that has impact on obviously on treatment and also on outcomes.
Thank you, Anne. Dr. Aliberti, would you like to add to that?
Yep, we had a consensus of experts recently published in the Lancet Respiratory Medicine, where more than 30 experts tackled the definition of what we were used to call bacterial colonization, that now we call chronic bacterial infection. And after a Delphi process, we decided to use a specific definition for randomized controlled trials, but also for clinical practice, in my opinion, because we can easily use this also in our daily practice, which is the evidence of a positive respiratory tract cultures for the same microorganisms by standard microbiology on two or more occasions, at least 3 months apart, over a 1 year period, with the patient being on a stable state and with the patient having a clinically significant bronchiectasis. This was the definition we decided to put together in that paper, because it seems to be a pragmatic and balanced definition that can be used also in patients with bronchiectasis that might have a sputum culture done at least twice every year. and it's reasonable also according to previous published literature. So this was one consensus definition of chronic infection.
Thank you, Stefano. I do think it's important to try to standardize these, so I appreciate the effort of that expert group. Dr. O'Donnell, do you use eradication protocols?
I do not, Chuck. I know this is a concept that comes out of our cystic fibrosis colleagues and research to attempt to eradicate Pseudomonas, particularly at the time of first identification. It's a more challenging problem in the non-CF population because many of these patients have been infected for many years and are first identified with the organism when we meet them for the first time, but have longstanding infection. So I find this concept a little bit challenging in our older non-CF population.
Well, let me switch to Dr. Aliberti. I'm curious, are you using eradication? And if you are, is it just for Pseudomonas or do you use it for other pathogens?
So, yes, I tend to do this in my clinical practice for Pseudomonas. Actually, this is the question about the question in the field of treatment of bronchiectasis, according to not only to experts, but also patients, because when the EMBARK and ELF organizations published the research priorities in bronchiectasis more than 5 years ago, eradication of Pseudomonas was the first priority for both experts and patients. So there is a need for both experts and patients to better understand this, although data are really, really limited. And I'm talking about one randomized control trials. There are several observational studies, mainly retrospective, showing that different eradication protocols are keeping patients Pseudomonas free for 6, 12 months or whatever, with some impact on signs and symptoms. So what I'm doing is what the ERS guidelines published in 2017 are suggesting. So considering in case of first Pseudomonas isolation with optimal respiratory physiotherapy and the other medical treatment in place to consider an eradication. And what I'm doing is using for outpatients ciprofloxacin for 2 weeks together with an inhaled antibiotic given for 3 months. It seems that there might be in some patients an improvement in signs and symptoms with some negative microbiology after the eradication, although in long term, during a long term period, Pseudomonas could be there again. Personally, I do not tend to eradicate any other pathogens, neither Haemophilus nor Staph aureus. I'm just focusing on Pseudomonas.
Okay. Dr. O'Donnell, I'm just curious, you're not using this. Is that because you've had experience in which you didn't think it was working?
Part of it is the evidence base, as Stefano alluded to, is very minimal here. I think this also begs the question of what is the term eradication and what exactly does that mean in terms of subsequent microbiology and actually patient outcomes. So I struggle with this. I think we really need more evidence in order to assess whether an intensive antibiotic protocol like Stefano discussed is really working for these patients.
And finally, Chuck, I was thinking that our audience is supposed to have this very clear in mind, that eradication treatment for Pseudomonas or for any other pathogen is an off-label treatment, not only based on expert opinion, but also in the majority of the countries is an off-label treatment because there are no licensed treatment for bronchiectasis so far, neither for FDA nor for EMA. So this adds some issues for both physicians and patients for For example, in my country, patients are supposed to sign an informed consent for the eradication of Pseudomonas being an off-label treatment, and patients are supposed also to pay for some drugs like the inhaled antibiotics for eradications. And the lack of data, as Professor O'Donnell said, and this off-label approach is limiting a lot the eradication treatment in our bronchiectasis patients.
Okay, so it sounds like an important area for further research. Well, I'd like to thank you, Dr. O'Donnell and Dr. Aliberti, for your comments today, and really appreciate your thoughts on treating chronic infection. Thank you very much. In this section, we're going to discuss available and emerging pharmacotherapeutic strategies. The British Thoracic Society has published an algorithm which looks at the stepwise management of patients with stable non-CF bronchiectasis. This is, I think, very useful, beginning with step one, treating the underlying disease, initiating airway clearance techniques, providing annual influenza vaccination, prompt antibiotics for the treatment of exacerbations, and self-management plan. And then when people move into frequent exacerbations, in this setting, three or more exacerbations per year, basically revisiting the airway clearance, adding physiotherapy for those who grow Pseudomonas from their respiratory specimen, considering long-term inhaled anti-pseudomonal antibiotic or long-term macrolide. And for other pathogens, consider long-term macrolides, long-term oral or inhaled targeted antibiotics. And if there are no pathogens, also considering long-term macrolides. If they're continuing to have frequent exacerbations, if you haven't already done so, you would start long-term macrolide and a long-term inhaled antibiotic. And then eventually, with particular very frequent exacerbators, like five or more exacerbations per year, consider regular intravenous antibiotics every 2 to 3 months. Now, there are some trials that have been recently published that are really very important. One was called the Willow trial. It was a randomized phase two placebo-controlled study of brensocatib in patients who've had two or more exacerbations in the last 12 months. This study, published in the New England Journal, did demonstrate that the time to the first exacerbation was significantly better in those who received either the 10 or the 25 milligram dose of brensocatib. There was a higher incidence of dental and skin adverse events with both doses, but these were pretty mild. Then we have a second study that looked at inhaled antibiotics, colistamethate sodium, which was the PROMISE 1 study. This was a phase 3 study of adult patients who had Pseudomonas in their sputum and two or more exacerbations, or one requiring IV antibiotics in the last 12 months. And very significantly, those who were on the inhaled colistamethate had a significantly reduced annual exacerbation rate, and importantly, similar proportion of patients with AEs between the two treatment arms. So these are just two trials that have recently been published. And it turns out there are multiple other trials that are occurring now. There's a phase 3 trial of the brensocatib called the Aspen trial. Benralizumab, the Mahala study, is currently enrolling. PROMISE 2, the colistamethate study, is also enrolling. And there are others that you should know about that are enrolling. And I can tell you there are more coming. So we're very excited in this field that we have so many clinical trials that are occurring for the first time. So let me get our panel's opinions on kind of what we're doing now and what they think about some of these new approaches to treatment. So Dr. O'Donnell, how do you select which therapeutic agents you're going to use in clinic?
Yes, I'm a big advocate of those British Thoracic Society guidelines because I do think it lays out a nice stepwise approach to the patient with bronchiectasis, and it really helps us clinicians to personalize the treatment. So when I see a patient with bronchiectasis, I first really spend a fair amount of time on educating the patient about the disease and planning a self-management type strategy like the BTS guidelines mention. I advocate for the patient to start airway clearance therapies, and usually that's something simple at first, even just walking or using an oscillatory positive expiratory pressure device. And then I step up the treatment based on the patient's symptoms and also the frequency of exacerbations, just like the BTS guidelines advocate for. So I use antibiotics, obviously, for exacerbations, but then if the patient is a frequent exacerbator, I will personalize the antibiotic prescription to the pathogen. And here I want to stress how important it is to do the sputum cultures so that you know which pathogens that you're dealing with. And finally, for the most severe patients, that multimodality therapy is mentioned in those guidelines, where you're using airway clearance and other modalities like exercise, pulmonary rehab, and then adding suppressive antibiotics, targeting the organisms and or using the macrolide for both its anti-infective and anti-inflammatory effects.
Thanks, Anne. Dr. Alberti, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, we are pretty much doing the same. Let me stress some simple but very important intervention. First of all, we should always think about some lifestyle changes in our patients with bronchiectasis for those who are smoking. So smoking cessation should be there, and also increase exercise capacity for those affected by sedentarisms, or for those who need to increase their performance status. Importantly, I always think about the management of comorbidities. So recognize and optimize the management of different comorbidities our patients with bronchiectasis might have, such as gastroesophageal reflux disease, chronic sinusitis, also cardiovascular diseases, osteopenia, osteoporosis, depression, anxiety, important comorbidities that might have an impact on their quality of life. And finally, we mentioned antibiotics, but let me also mention vaccinations, because as the BTS are suggesting, anti-influenza vaccination should be there. To be honest, we are also thinking about anti-pneumococcal vaccination and anti-hemophilus influenza for some patients, and of course anti-SARS-CoV-2 vaccination in all our patients with bronchiectasis. And finally, one more thing would be not only adding treatment, but also withdrawing treatment. And I'm talking about inhaled corticosteroids. For example, for those bronchiectasis patients who do not deserve, do not need ICS because they do not have asthma, they do not have ABPA, they do not have a clear and demonstrated eosinophilic inflammation. And we know from the other side that ICS is a risk factor for NTM, for non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And we also have data on COPD that ICS might increase the prevalence of pneumonia. So not only adding treatment, but in this case also withdrawing treatment.
Thank you, Stefano. I think that last point about inhaled steroids is very important. And as these investigational drugs hopefully reach our patients, I mean, how do you see them being used in clinical practice?
Yes, I think it's exciting that we have this research explosion, if you will, in bronchiectasis, so that we are examining the potential of a new drug like the neutrophil elastase inhibitor class of drugs, and also various anti-inflammatory drugs. So, you know, we've gone through a lot of clinical trials with inhaled antibiotics with mostly mixed results. And we've modeled after cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis in many of our trials, and that hasn't panned out so well. So the emergence of these new classes of drugs and new protocols for the way we're using existing drugs and looking at those in clinical trials is very, very exciting and really portends well for the care of our patients.
Thanks, Anne. I totally agree with your comments. And let me ask the last question to Dr. Aliberti, because he's been involved and published in this area, which is, how would the different mechanism of action of these emerging agents influence your choice of therapy?
Yeah, thank you, Chuck. This is interesting because guidelines are reviewing published data, and experts are giving recommendations according to published data. The point is that in clinical practice, we are, of course, following guidelines, but we tend to identify clinical phenotypes and endotypes in our bronchiectasis patients because we might have now or in the future some drugs targeting that. You mentioned brensocatib. This means neutrophilic inflammation. So one of my goals is to understand if my patient has a neutrophilic inflammation ongoing in the lung. And we can do this in the next future because we have tools that can measure neutrophil elastase in the sputum, like the NISTIC, for example. We tend to evaluate if our patient has an eosinophilic inflammation, a sort of T2 high endotype, because we might have biological drugs for these patients, and we have data about that. And also, we tend to understand also the hypersecretive patients where not only respiratory physiotherapy, but also some clever and accurate use of mucoactive agents might have a place in their therapy. So we are now in the area of trying to move a little bit forward and identify endotypes and clinical phenotypes in also in our clinic.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank both panelists, Dr. O'Donnell and Aliberti, for a great discussion of things to come and the excitement that I think we're feeling in this field with new drugs coming. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Infectious Diseases at www.touchinfectiousdiseases.com.